So finally, after five sessions, we're moving on
from the laws that have to do with the Eved Ivri, with the Hebrew slave, and we're moving on to the next theme that is discussed in Parshat Mishpatim, the theme of homicide. Reading in English, the next verse is, "He who fatally strikes a man shall be put to death. If he did not do it by design, but it came about by an act of God." I like that translation. The Hebrew there is Baha Elohim Ina Liyadzo. It came about by an act of God. "I will assign you a place to which he can flee. But on the other hand, when a man schemes against another and kills him treacherously, you shall take him from my very altar to be put to death." There are many issues here to discuss, and we will, I hope, discuss all of the important issues connected with this text. But we will begin with the question of the placement, you know, trying to understand the structure. So when we started dealing with the rules of the Eved Ivri, of the Hebrew slave, the first question we asked was, why does Parshat Mishpatim begin with the rules of the Eved Ivri? What's the significance of beginning with that? And now the question is, do the next laws that have to do with homicide have anything to do with the previous laws? You're reading a law code. I'll tell you the truth. I don't have very much experience in reading any law codes from the 20th or the 21st century. Those of you who are in Canada, I don't know how many of you have ever picked up the Criminal Code of Canada to read it. I can say that I have not. And I assume that only people who have studied in law school have done something like that. I'm guessing that the laws in the Criminal Code of Canada presumably are independent, that you don't ask the question as you're reading the criminal code, why does law Y follow law X? And so the question, this is a methodological question. When you're reading a series of laws, should you be asking why, what is the purpose of the order that the legislator had when writing this law code? Now, you could say that, okay, when you deal with a human law code, then you wouldn't ask a question like that. But when you deal with a divine law code, then maybe, you know, aside from the fact that the law code is there in order to tell you what to do in specific situations so you'll know what the law is, the law code may be there to teach you something. So should you be looking to try to connect? Should you be trying to understand why does the law code go in the specific way in which it goes? So I thought that I'd just kick off with two comments here of Ibn Ezra on this, on the general subject. In the second commentary that Ibn Ezra wrote on Exodus, which in most standard Mikraot Gedolot, the compendia of the traditional commentators, this is what you find for Ibn Ezra's commentary on Exodus. Ibn Ezra wrote two commentaries on Exodus. One he wrote in Italy, presumably in the 1130s, and the other one he wrote in France, presumably in the 1140s. So in the 1140s, writing on the subject, he says, "Before I begin my commentary, I will formulate a principle. Each law or mitzvah stands independently. Kol mishpat o mitzvah, kol echad omeid bifnei atzmo." That makes a lot of sense. It's a sensible way of saying that there are various laws. The law codes, that they have to be put in some order. It's not like a narrative where you would ask the question in a narrative, why is there a flashback? Why is there a break in the chronological order of the text? So he begins his commentary by making that, Omar l'cha klal, here's my
principle on this. But then he says, when we can find a reason why one law or one mitzvah is juxtaposed with the next one, we will do whatever we can to explain. Nidabik b'chol yecholteinu, he says, you know, we'll, I'm going to give it the great college try. I'm going to do the best job possible to explain why one mitzvah follows the next one, why the legislator chose to organize the text in the way that it did. And this is, he writes this, incidentally, in the commentary on Mishpatim, where it seems as if the laws are in, it seems as if the laws are in a certain hodgepodge. And we will, as we continue to go through Mishpatim, we will continue to deal with this issue. Is there to be seen some kind of order of what's going on here, some kind of logic to the order of what's going on? And then Ibn Ezra finishes this commentary. If we can't find an explanation for the order of the laws, we will assume that it is because of our insufficient intellects. So, careful reading of this text of Ibn Ezra, he is saying there definitely is a reason. I know that there is a reason. On the one hand, I know that each mitzvah stands on its own. And as long as I understand study the mitzvah on its own, I'll be able to understand it. But there's a message in the order. The Torah has ordered these rules in a specific order, and it's a good idea to try to find what the principle of the order is. Nidabek b'chol yecholteinu. We'll do whatever we can to find what that reason is. And there is a reason, and sometimes we'll find it, and sometimes we will fail. So that's what Ibn Ezra wrote in his second commentary on Exodus. In his first commentary on the Torah, he makes a number of statements on the topic. What we have, if you open up the standard Mikraot Gedolot, what we have is Ibn Ezra's Italian commentary, the commentary that he wrote in Italy in the 1130s on all five Chumashim. When he moved to France, he wrote a commentary on Exodus, and for some reason, the printers who came up with the first Mikraot Gedolot decided to use the later version of the commentary on Exodus, and the early version of the commentaries on the other books of the Torah, because that's all that existed. There is evidence that Ibn Ezra began working on a second version of his commentary on Exodus, on Genesis, on Bereshit, and we have a few excerpts from that, but he never finished that work. So all of what you find in a standard Mikraot Gedolot, other than some of the fancy ones today that give you both the older commentary and the newer one, is from his Italian days. So this is what he said when he was still in Italy. He says, although each mitzvah stands independently, there's a kind of midrash possible about the juxtaposition of texts. Let's look at the Hebrew for those of you who can handle the Hebrew. Yesh kidmut drash. So, is Ibn Ezra saying the same thing here in his earlier commentary as he says this later? I agree with Susan, who's shaking her head. No, he has apparently changed his mind on the subject. When he is in Italy, he says, you can come up with a drash. You know, if we look consistently at Ibn Ezra's attitude to Midrash, he thinks that Midrash is something added to the text that isn't really there in the text, but it's something that a rabbi, an educator, adds into the text. And so an educator might come up with some kind of explanation of why this mitzvah follows another mitzvah. This is, according to most readings of the text of Ibn Ezra, this is a shift in his feeling on the subject. When he says here, Nidabek b'chol yecholteinu, we'll do everything we can to explain the connection between the texts. And if we don't figure it out, we'll just say that chosar da'ateinu, it's our insufficient intellect.
So it seems that he's changed his mind on this subject. For those of you who want further reading on the subject and who can read Hebrew, a scholar here in Israel named Ayelet Zeidler has written an article called Omar Lecha Klal, Klal V'Yisumo B'Perushei Ben Ezra L'Smichut Mitzvot, where she discusses this shift that took place in Ibn Ezra as the years went on, about how in the beginning Ibn Ezra looked with disdain on the attempt to connect different laws to each other. And then when he got a little older, he said, you know, maybe it is in the text. I'm sure that many of you know, but perhaps not all of you know, these days it is possible to find almost any academic article that has been written in the last 50 years or so without leaving the comfort of your chair at home. All you have to do is go to a site called academia.edu, and if you can type in the name of this article or the name of Ayelet Zeidler, who wrote this article, you'll find her article there, and it'll be available in a PDF. So anyone who wishes to follow up on this and see how she explains this change in the thinking of Ibn Ezra over the years. And, you know, I think we can all understand that there are two reasonable ways of looking at this question about whether this is or is not meaningful, the order in which the laws are presented here. Rabbi Ephraim of Lunschitz, who wrote the commentary, he became afterwards the chief rabbi of Prague, but he was born in Lunschitz in Poland, writes about, again, at the beginning of this week's Parsha, many tried to explain the order of the various mitzvot in this Torah portion in Mishpatim. For example, Rabbi Yitzhak Karo, that's not Rabbi Joseph Karo, that's Rabbi Joseph Karo's uncle, Rabbi Yitzhak Karo and Rabbi Isaac Abarbanel, both of them in the early 16th century. What they write does not appeal to me, so I won't dwell on their explanation. So still people are arguing in the 16th, 17th century, is this a worthwhile thing to try to do? And, you know, somebody like Abarbanel will spend a ton of time trying to explain what the order of the text is. One explanation of the order, I think we saw a few weeks ago, we saw Rabbi
David Zvi Hoffman, early 20th century Germany, talks about why, we saw a number of reasons why the law code would begin with rules of slaves. And of course, the simplest explanation is that the Israelites had just finished being slaves, and they were told that they were leaving the house of slavery. And so they had to be told, you know, what's going to be your attitude to slavery? And there's going to be no such thing as permanent slavery of an Ivri. Hoffman made that point. And then he writes here to explain that after the laws of slaves, why do we go to the laws of homicide? He writes, Yoter misheyesh lechabed et cheruto ha'ishit shel ha'adam, yesh lechabed et chayav. Even more than one must protect the personal liberty of other people, one must protect their lives. Those of you who know me, who have been in classes of mine before, I know that I almost always resist the temptation of connecting these classical texts to issues going on in modern society, but I can't resist. Just when I was looking over these texts this week, preparing for the class, and I saw this line here, it just reminded me of something else that I read this week. This is I have no idea who this cardinal is, who lives in Chicago right now, But here's what he said. What he just said last week or the week before, and you'll obviously all be able to figure out what the context is. The right to stay alive trumps the right to have weapons. As the Second Amendment did not come down from Sinai. I was really surprised to see the Catholics use that phrase also, that it's not Torah Lemoshe Sinai. It didn't come from Sinai. The right to bear arms will never be more important than human life. And you know, obviously, Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman was not relating to this, but he does say the same idea that the trouble moving around from one slide to another. Okay, here we go. He said, even more than one must protect the personal liberty of other people, one must protect their lives. And that's it. So the first verses about slavery were to protect the personal liberties of other people. And then we move on to protecting their lives. I really like the message of David Zvi Hoffman, and I really like the message of this cardinal from Chicago. Is this a very good way of explaining what's going on in the text, though? I don't know about that. If I were a student in Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman's class in early 20th century Germany, I'd say to him, well, if the Torah is trying to teach us that protecting people's lives is more important even than protecting their personal liberties, wouldn't it make sense to talk about their lives before you talk about the personal liberties, talking about freedom? He's trying to argue that it's like a corrective to the laws of slavery. As I said, I like the idea. Again, I'm not certain that it really does a good job of explaining this shift from the discussion of the laws of slaves to the discussion of the laws, the Jewish attitude towards homicide. Okay. Here's Rabbeinu Bachya ben Asher writing in the 13th, 14th century, argues, Achar shehishlim din eved ivri sheitchil bo keneged dibur rishon shebeluach rishon, hitchil bedin haretzicha keneged dibur rishon shebeluach sheni. Having concluded the legislation concerning Jewish slaves, a subject conceptually linked to the first commandment on the first tablet of the Decalogue of the Ten Commandments, the Torah returns to the first commandment on the second tablet, the law about murder. This is neat. Again, I don't know if it's convincing, but it is neat. And the idea, we've seen this idea before, that the laws in Mishpatim may very well all be an expansion of the Decalogue, that the legislator here is like expanding on the Decalogue. And so since the first commandment in the Decalogue says that I have taken you out of the house of Abadim, you are no longer Abadim, then Mishpatim begins by expanding on what it means to be an Eved. And then since the second tablet began, Lo Tirtzach, thou shalt not commit murder, so now we have an expansion on that. Why did they not expand on commandments 2, 3, 4, and 5? Bachya ben Asher does not explain. You kind of get the impression when you see people talking about these kinds explanations of the juxtaposition, explanations of the order, you get the idea, you know, kind of like Ibn Ezra said in his first idea, there's, you know, you can connect it with a drash, you can find a nice drash that will connect these things to each other, it might make you feel good, but it's not certain that that is what the original intent of the author if it is still permissible to ask what was the original intent of the author, it's not clear that that was the original intent of the author.
Rashbam also argues that
to understand what's going on here, we should look back to the Decalogue, to the Ten Commandments, since they were already told, you shall not murder, and they were also told, honor your father and your mother. Now the text explains the penalty involved if one breaks those laws. And right after the law that talks about killing, talks about homicide, then we have the laws of what happens if a person strikes a parent without killing a parent. Similarly, one should explain that the verse here, he who kidnaps a man and sells him, also here in Parshat Mishpatim, is written as an elaboration of the verse, you shall not steal. And the rabbis explained that that verse back in the Decalogue refers to kidnapping, for one sees from the context that the text is referring to a capital offense to kidnapping, lo tignov, in the standard rabbinic understanding meant do not kidnap. And there's another verse in Leviticus, lo tignovu, and from that we learn that that stealing of money is forbidden. And so Rashbam is not managing to explain every aspect here of the order, but he says that if you look carefully at the laws here in Parshat Mishpatim, you see that they are elaborations of what was said in the Decalogue, and particularly in standard rabbinic understanding, there are two kinds of things that the Torah can be teaching you about something that is forbidden. A, the fact that it is forbidden, and B, what the penalty is for it. And so in the Decalogue, in the Ten Commandments, we have a list of the things that are forbidden, but it doesn't say what the penalties are for them. And so Rashbam says, okay, Parshat Mishpatim, one of the goals of Parshat Mishpatim is to try to tell us what the penalties are for various infractions.
Attractive explanation of what's going on here in the order of what's happening here in Parshat Mishpatim.
I say that this is attractive, and I'll try to explain
A, why it's attractive,
and B, why almost nobody else says this except for Abraham Ibn Ezra. So Ibn Ezra writes, who fatally strikes a man, the reason this follows the laws dealing with male and female slaves is that scripture wanted in the continuation, when you get to verses 20 and 21, to explain what happens to someone who strikes his slave, male or female, and kills that slave. In our verse, fatally striking a man is a reference to a free Israelite, not to a slave. The reason that I find this a very attractive explanation of the structure of Parshat Mishpatim is that Avadim keeps showing up in the in the laws. When we get to the we get to the goring ox, so it says what happens if an ox gores and injures a free person, and what happens if it's a child, and what happens if it's a slave. And so to say that the major organizing principle, at least at the beginning of Parshat Mishpatim, is slaves, and it begins by giving you 11 verses that are specifically about slaves. And now the text will get into various discussions of criminal acts and of torts. And then it will say, and here's what happens if the victim of this criminal act or the tort is a free person. And here's what happens if the victim of that free act, of that criminal act, is not a free person, but is a slave. It really does work nicely to explain what's going on in chapter, a lot of what's going on here in chapter 21. There is, though, a very big problem with Ibn Ezra's approach. Ibn Ezra's approach is premised on the assumption that the slave of the beginning of chapter 21 is the same as the slave in the continuation of chapter 21. And the assumption of rabbinic literature is that there are two kinds of slaves. There is the Eved Ivri, the slave who is a Hebrew slave. We'll see this when we get to further verses that talk about the slaves. The rabbis say that the further verses talking about slaves in this chapter are not about the Eved Ivri. And that's why I think nobody before the days of Ibn Ezra offered this explanation of the text, because this explanation of the text, you know, it works really nicely if the slaves being discussed in the beginning of chapter 21 are the same kinds of slaves as the ones in the continuation of chapter 21. So there's an example of Ibn Ezra, who doesn't do this all that often, but sometimes he offers an explanation that is at odds with the rabbinic understanding of the understanding of the text. Okay. So when Rashi looks at these laws about homicide, he begins his commentary here on chapter 21. He writes, "Kama ktuvim ne'emru b'mitat rotzchim." Many apparently redundant verses were written dealing with murderers. I will explain what I can about why all these verses were written. The implication of Rashi's comment here, Masha biyadi lefarish afarish, whatever I can explain, I will explain, is that Rashi is admitting that he is not able to explain everything, all of these verses. Now, many of us would say that why are there so many verses about murder in the Bible? Because the Bible wishes to emphasize just how terrible an action murder is, and you emphasize through repetition and saying it in all sorts of different ways is a way of trying to make it totally clear to people. It also implies that it is a problem in society if they're constantly emphasizing this, as in most societies in history, murder was a problem. So Rashi gives a kind of technical halachic analysis to try to explain why there are so many verses about murder in the Bible. I only gave you a small part of the text here. Those of you who wish can go and read, can read at greater length than Rashi. But as Rashi said, the ones that I'm able to explain, I will explain. He doesn't explain all the verses that have to do with murderers in the Bible, but he does explain a fair number of them. Okay, first of all, so what our verse here, Ish Vamet. Why does it say Ish Vamet? Lama Ne'amar, why is this said? Since it said in Leviticus, this is kind of the standard halachis understanding of the text of the Bible, what we now call intertextuality, that the text is connected to each other. All the parts of the text are connected to each other, not just what are the parts of the text that are juxtaposed to each other, that are sitting beside each other, but all the texts of the Torah are connected to each other. So why does it say our verse here? Because if it had only said that verse in Leviticus, one who strikes another person shall surely be put to death. Ki yakeh kol nefesh adam mot yumat. I might have inferred that mere smiting without killing is subject to the death penalty. And that's why scripture here has to say, makeh ish bamit, to make it clear that there isn't a death penalty just for assault and battery. There is a death penalty for murder. We're going to talk, incidentally, for those of you who are concerned about all of the discussion here of the capital penalty. We will talk about the capital penalty and the significance of the fact that the Torah attaches a capital penalty to murder and to many other things. We will talk about that, presumably not this week, but presumably next week we will get to that topic. So from a technical reading of that verse in Vayikra, I might have thought that any kind of assault and battery would lead to the death penalty, and that's why it has to say here, it's a corrective, it has to say here, makeh ish bamit mot yumat. So that's Rashi's first comment here. His second comment, on the other hand, if it had stated here, whoever fatally strikes a man, and it had not stated there, one who strikes another person, I might have inferred that murderers are not guilty or are not punished with the capital penalty unless they killed a man. How would I know that the rule applies if the victim is a woman or a minor? And that's why scripture says, one who strikes another person, kol nefesh adam refers to all human beings, men, women, children, shall surely be put to death. And so that includes women and children. In other words, that the Torah wants us to be reading these verses together with each other and understanding them with each other. And you put the verses together, then you will get all the laws of the all the laws of murder. Okay, so Rashi, not really setting out to do this, has actually introduced an interesting issue into our understanding of the text. In that last comment that we said, we might have thought from that verse that only somebody who killed a man would be subject to the death penalty, and that's why it says any human being. Rashi probably did not know this, but I should put it differently. Rashi certainly didn't know this. The ancient law codes of the ancient Near East were found in archaeological digs in the like in the 19th and 20th century. Various law codes that are older than the Torah, and in the law codes that are older than the Torah, there is a clear differentiation in the value of the lives of different human beings. In future weeks, we will see some examples from the law code of Hammurabi, from the law code of Esh Nunna, where it depends on who the victim is. And Rashi, just, you know, not knowing that this is really the problem, he just said, you know, I might have thought that there's a difference between the values of the lives of different human beings, and that's why the Torah says, kol nefesh adam. That's Rashi, without knowing what we know now about the ancient Near East, put his finger on one of the chidushim, one of the innovations of the Torah, which was in its claim that the lives of all human beings are of equal value when it comes to murder and to when it comes to somebody being a victim of crime. We'll talk specifically about the Eved who is not a Jewish Eved in the continuation, but just in general, the first thing it says about the killing of a of an eved is nakom yinakem, that that if you if you kill your slave, including a non-Jewish slave, it is a culpable offense. And we already saw that there were many societies in the ancient world that even into modern times, and even in the United States of the beginning of the 19th century, where it wasn't something that somebody could be put on in some of the states of the United States in the beginning of the 19th century, killing your slave was not something for which you could be held culpable. We saw an overview of when attitudes started to change in different cultures about the question about whether you are or are not allowed to kill your slave. But the Torah makes it extremely clear. The Torah gets into a distinction there that we'll talk about when we get to verses 20 and 21. But in general, Nakom Yinakem. You are punished. It is culpable. And the rabbi said it means it's the death penalty for somebody who kills their non-Jewish slave. This brings us, I think, now to the crux of the what I think interests many of us about the laws of the Torah. When it comes to homicide, and that's the question of capital punishment, those of you who are in Canada, there is no capital punishment anymore. Those of you who are in the United States, in many states of the Union, there is no capital punishment, and some there is. Those of you who are in Israel, capital punishment is on the books only for mass murder, and the only person who was executed by an Israeli court was Adolf Eichmann. So capital punishment is not something that occurs in most cultured societies these days. And I think that many of us, when we're reading through the Torah, we are troubled. We feel a little funny when we see the extent to which so many things are capital crimes in the Torah. We'll have more to say about this, but I just want to begin the discussion today with an article written by Professor Moshe Greenberg in 1960, an article that later turned into a book on the subject, a fascinating article with one of the most boring titles of any articles that have ever been written. It's called Some Postulates of Biblical Criminal Law. He didn't want to make too grandiose a claim that it was all the ideas of biblical criminal law, but some of the postulates of biblical criminal law. Because this article is from 1960, it's hard to find an easily readable copy on the internet. And so part of it here I just retyped, and some of it I managed to copy and paste from the original article. Okay. Professor Greenberg writes, the right of pardon in capital cases. For those of you who don't know, Professor Greenberg taught at the University of Pennsylvania for many years, and then he made Aliyah in not that many years after 1960. I think in 1970 or 1971, he made Aliyah, and he taught at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. I happened to be a student in 1969-70, just after graduating from the Community Hebrew Academy of Toronto. I was a student in the Bible department at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and I was a very unhappy camper. And I sometimes ask myself how my life might have been different if Professor Greenberg had made Aliyah a year or two earlier, and I had had a chance to study with him, because later on, I just saw him as being one of the Gedolim, one of the great people of academia when it comes to biblical studies. And I won't name the professors that I had in 1969-70 that I was less impressed with. Okay, so Greenberg writes, the right of pardon in capital cases that Near Eastern law gives to the king is unknown to biblical law. This is throughout Near Eastern law. The principle is that the king is known to have the right to pardon in capital cases. Here would seem to be another indication of the literalness with which the doctrine of the divine authorship of the law was felt in Israel. So this is one of his major claims in the article, that whatever, he says, whatever you think about the claim that God gave the laws of the Torah to people, it is at the core of the Torah is that argument that these laws come from God. And the Torah relates to these laws in a specific way because the laws come from God. And that is one of the, and he gives in this article many examples of how the belief that a law code comes from God affects the way that the law code is implemented. And so throughout the ancient world, it was understood that when somebody committed a capital crime, then the king had the right to pardon the person so they would not be put to death. And Greenberg writes, only the author of the law has the power to waive it. In Mesopotamia, he is the king. In Israel, no man, no person. The law does not come from a person. The law comes from God. And that's why you see this distinction that the king is allowed to pardon in the throughout the ancient Near East. And I would argue that well beyond the ancient Near East, at least from the linguistic point of view, and if I were to be put in trial in Canada for some kind of criminal action, the case would be called R versus Martin Lochin. R meaning Regina, meaning the queen. The queen is accusing, the queen is the source of the legislation, at least in theory. The queen is seen as being the source of the legislation. That's the and in 19th century England, I just finished reading, my wife has been asking me for years, has been recommending to me to read the book Far From the Madding Crowd, and I just finished reading it a couple of days ago. For those of you who have never read Far From the Madding Crowd, it's just a great 19th century novel. And in the novel, somebody commits murder and he is sentenced to death, and a pardon comes in at the last moment after the I'm sorry if it's a spoiler, a pardon comes in at the last moment and just before the person is going to be hanged, a word is received that he is to be kept alive at the pleasure of the queen. So in the 19th century, at least from the linguistic point of view, this idea that was central in the ancient Near East, that the king has the power of pardoning, still in 19th century England, did they really go to Queen Victoria and say to her, should this person be put to death or not? I kind of doubt if the decision was being made by the queen herself. You know, in the United States, since there are no kings and queens, it's the state versus Martin Lochin if there are criminal proceedings going on against me, and if the governor has the right to pardon in the United States because of the understanding that the law comes from the legislature of the United States. And there have been many cases in recent history, at least, of people who were sentenced to death in the United States. And at the last moment, the governor provides the provides a pardon. And, you know, on some level, I guess many of us are pleased with the fact that there is a human being there who has the power to commute a sentence to reduce a capital sentence. But Greenberg says that it goes against the spirit of the Bible, that the spirit of the Bible is that the law comes from God. And because of that, no human being has the right to pardon. Greenberg continues, and here he's beginning to argue against a number of scholars who had written on this subject beforehand. The unexampled severity of biblical law on the subject of homicide has been considered. Some scholars who have written about this, some biblical critics who have written about this, have written that is a sign that the law code is primitive, or archaic, or a reflex of Bedouin vendetta customs. But precisely the law of homicide cannot be counted for on any such grounds. So there were biblical critics who argued that the Bible is, you know, like from a more primitive level of moral developments. There were a lot of biblical critics who didn't like the Bible very much and who argued that in other societies around the Israelites, they had a more developed sense of justice, which said that, okay, in theory, this is a capital crime, but there should be some way of compensating. There should be a way in which the murderer is capable of is capable of compensating, and there's something archaic or old-fashioned or vendetta-like about the Bible. That's what the biblical critics who Greenberg is disagreeing with were saying. And Greenberg says, no, they just don't understand what's going on in biblical law. What's going on in biblical law is the understanding that the laws come from God, and the God here in chapter 21 and verse 1 turns to Moses and says, and, you know, here's the laws that you should put before them, and that the, you know, these laws are understood as coming from God. And then at the end of the law code here, at the end of the covenant code, what they do is that they have a covenant. That's why it's called the covenant code, a breach between God and the Israelites because of these laws. And that this is the key to understanding these laws, including the law of homicide, this understanding that the laws come from God. Okay, I think that I am going to stop here. I have more to say about Greenberg, but I think we'll pick up with Greenberg next week, and I'll now take a look at the chat and see if there are any comments. Zoom user asked, didn't the rabbis find ways around capital punishment in the Talmud? They certainly did, and we will talk about that. Is the Hebrew Bible trying to make a point? The rabbis did not come up with any way of saying that somebody had the right to forgive after a trial. The Torah makes it clear that a trial is necessary, witnesses are necessary, and the rabbis found ways to make it extremely difficult to convict a murderer. And they did that not by commuting the sentences, but through but through setting up an extremely high threshold for what constitutes proof, so that, as the Mishnah says, in the end, a Sanhedrin that actually put somebody to death once every 7 years, or perhaps once every 70 years, was considered a bloodthirsty Sanhedrin. Cromwell killed the monarch. Only linguistic doesn't mean Victoria. Yeah, it doesn't mean the Victoria literature. I agree with iPhone, who wrote this. Yes, and I agree that also that they say Regina, the queen, against Marty Lashen doesn't mean. Yes, and Hardy is only a novel. I don't take it, but I'm pretty certain that when Hardy says this, it's because that was the language that was used. And okay, so you want to argue that this was a relic of a previous time. Okay, I'll accept this. This is a relic of a previous time, but still the fact that they're using that language is the idea of connecting the monarch with the decision to commute. So that's, I still argue that it has some significance, and that's, Lauren says correctly, that's why the prosecutor in Canada is called the Crown's Counsel. The Queen has appointed somebody to be, to stand up for her and to make sure that the person who is guilty is found. Marty writes, I have the impression that the sages deliberately avoid the explanation that repetition is done for purposes of emphasis by insisting that whenever a word or sentence is repeated, it is for the purpose of calling attention to a chidush. I agree with you totally, Marty, that is the standard rabbinic understanding, that it's considered like too cheap to just say that it's for the sake of emphasis, but they want one scholar named Yaakov Elman, Zichrono Libracha, coined the term omnisignificance, that everything is significant in the Torah, that, you know, like we have omnipotence and omniscience and omnibenevolent, we also have omnisignificant, that every word in the Torah has significance, and the significance is not just of a rhetorical level that it's there in order to emphasize, but it's there in order to teach something. Yes, Canada just changed law of indefinite sentence for killing a person to, after 25 years, everyone now can apply for parole, no matter how heinous a crime. I'm not totally happy to hear that, but thank you for bringing that to my attention. And a word from our sponsors from Torah in Motion. It will be a different link, which means you'll get in the pre-class emails as per usual. It won't be the same link. There are a couple of more comments that came in. Thank you for welcoming me back to New York. I'm not booked to be teaching any classes locally, except I am going to a Shavuot retreat. Anybody who's going to be at the Shavuot retreat at in Copaic, New York, I'll be teaching there on Shavuot. The change was a Supreme Court decision. Oh, that's very interesting. It wasn't the legislature that decided, the Supreme Court decided that. And that's why we're celebrating the Queen's Jubilee tomorrow. She's a symbol, because presidents often disappoint. Very good. Thank you, Irene. And speaking of Shavuot, I wish you all a very happy holiday, and hope that people get a chance to learn a lot of good Torah wherever you are. I'm sure there are Torah classes around, not on the web, but in person. And thank God that we are now at the stage where we can study in person. Last week when I taught, I didn't bother telling anybody that I had COVID last week, because I had one of the mildest cases of COVID that anybody ever had, but I was in isolation. I think it's permissible when you're in isolation to teach a bunch of people on Zoom, and I was feeling just fine. And now, obviously, I'm healthy enough to get on an airplane and to get a negative COVID test to be able to fly into the United States, and doing fine. I wish you all good health, And if anybody ever gets a case of COVID, it should be as mild as, somebody writes in that 3 weeks later, she's still not doing that great. I'm sorry to hear that. And I hope that anybody else who gets a case should have a case as mild as what I had. Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
Bye-bye.